You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hey, Alex.
Hey, Nick.
Hey, what time is it over there, buddy?
It's early. Well, it's not so early. For normal people, it's not early. It's about 7:30.
Here's what I love about that, dude. I, since this has started, have not gotten up before double digits a.m.
Every day?
I rise. I my eyes open, I'd say about 7, 8 a.m.
But you don't feel the need to get up.
And this makes me feel, because our guest is nothing if not a hard worker, I now feel like an idiot because I'm realizing there are so many hours that I have wasted.
There are so many hours in the day between, like 7 and 10 a.m.
There's a lot
to do things.
There's a lot that could be done in those hours. I could have made Huevos Rancheros.
You could have. I found finally our Twitter page.
Oh, did finally?
I didn't realize how much work you had been putting into that.
Yeah, you understand that the first time I opened that Twitter page, I texted you and I said, "Hey, Alex, here's the Twitter page."
No, I knew it existed, but I finally saw like what you've been posting. And yeah. I just feel like maybe I'm going to need to like curate it a little bit.
Talk to me about that. What are you afraid of?
So yeah, let's just go through here one at a time. Okay.
Oh, wow. We're doing this.
You know, Fred Willard, RIP. Love
RIP, because he's amazing.
But followed closely by Brendan Fraser in George of the Jungle dancing.
If you did not have any sort of sexual awakening to Brendan Fraser in George of...
A flamethrower. Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt.
Yes.
A poster for The Shining.
Yes.
Spike Lee and Tim Curry. What's the common theme here? Like, what's the...
There is not one black person.
Little Justice. Fuck yeah.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Little Justice, this thing that we do. I am the terrible Nick Walker. Who are you?
The great Alex Smolo.
That is grand. We are so, so, so very fortunate to have this guest with us today. This guest is pretty much our boss at this point, but like also just an awesome person. She is the founder and the creator of Broadway Podcast Network, which is so, you know, we are so grateful. Hosts are our terrible podcast for some odd reason. And she's also just, you know, a prolific Broadway producer. And what I just found out about a week and a half ago, a former Imagineer, which we have to talk about because one of the things that we have never talked about on this podcast is both mine and Alex's love of Disney parks.
How have we never gotten into that?
I'm not sure.
Is it intentional that we stay away from it?
I think that for people's palatability of us, I think that we definitely, you know, because we would just talk about it incessantly. We wouldn't talk about movies. And that's probably what's going to happen today. Dory, come on in here, first of all.
Hi. I am so honored to be with you guys.
No, thank you for being here. Thank you for putting up with us.
I love your podcast.
No, you're very kind. We try.
Well, I try.
You do try. What I think, I mean, what I was about to say is Dory, not only was Dory an Imagineer, but her baby, which is one of my favorite rides, Muppet Vision 3D, which is why our topic today is Muppet movies, because we have to talk about Muppets and we have to talk about Muppet Vision 3D and we have to talk about Disney parks. I'm very excited. Like, I don't know if you can tell. I'm very excited about this. So Dory, I don't like, there's so much I want to ask you, but like, just take us back to that moment. What is this for you? Imagineering, how?
You know, it just was one of the absolute best times of my entire life, times a thousand. I grew up in Los Angeles, going to Disneyland all the time. I was just wanted so badly to understand how everything worked behind the scenes and how it was just transporting for me and feel good. And of course, I grew up on the Muppets and was obsessed with Kermit and Fozzie Bear and Miss Piggy. And they meant the world to me. They were teaching me about life all the time. And so one of my dreams in life was to be an Imagineer, to work behind the curtain, figure out how it all works and to help make it happen. And so I had the most amazing opportunity to run a division making the theme park movies. And we worked very closely with Jim Henson on a number of projects, including Muppet Vision 3D. And it was just, it was a dream. Of course, it ended. I'm so proud of the film, but it ended so tragically because we lost Jim at the end of the shoot. But the whole experience, I treasure it so much, and the most amazing group of people I've ever worked with.
That's amazing.
I mean, it's such a special thing. Back when it was called MGM Studios, not Hollywood Studios, it was tucked away back by where the, now, isn't there that beer place there now? Like, or it's because it's right where Galaxy's Edge is now. You have to understand, there's so many rides that I, and experiences in Disney Park that I, as a kid, was terrified of. And like, so for instance, my favorite, if you talk about Disneyland, my favorite story when I was a child, and Alex will get a kick out of this, I could not do for the life of me the Indiana Jones adventure. Because you were scared of it? I was terrified. I literally,
yeah, that makes sense.
I was terrified, guys. I literally got on that ride and it was that big Jeep and I had just seen Jurassic Park, which had, you know, traumatized me, but also inspired me. And I was like, I don't know where this car is going, but it reminds me of the car from Jurassic Park. I need to get out of here now. And I literally, as the lap bar was coming down, I was like, no, I need to, nope. And I just stood up and my mom was like, Nick, what are you doing? Like the ride is like where they're about to start. They were about to give the thumbs up. And I was like, nope, I'll just wait. And so my stepdad had to get out of the ride with me. And like wait, and he was like so clearly angry because he wanted to do this ride, and we had waited in like 3 hours for this ride.
Yeah, because it took forever to get there.
Yeah, this was like before. This was still when it was like, you know, like e-tickets and all that. You know, it was like all this stuff. So like you had to like wait. There was no fast pass, I don't think, yet. So you literally waited. But Muppet Vision was one of those. I mean, you know, it almost the one that I would compare it to is almost PhilharMagic. It's just one of those things that you just see these characters that you know and that you love so deeply, and like it just overwhelms you. So talk to us about, I mean, you talked a little bit about this, but what was that like, kind of having that consultation and that work with Mr. Henson? I mean, like, clearly this is all his brainchild. What was he like as a collaborator? What was he, you know, what was his process?
He was an incredible collaborator. He surrounded himself with an extraordinary group of people. Of course, the Muppeteers were geniuses. They were just geniuses. They were so funny. They were incredible collaborators. They played off of each other. But the process with us, I was representing Disney, you know, in the mix. So I was supervising Muppet Vision on behalf of Disney, which was an interesting situation because you take this incredible team of imaginative, crazy puppeteers. And they are, you know, when you think about their movies and you think about Muppet Vision, you think about their work, it's like crazy and all over the place. And then, you know, Disney is much more buttoned up and they're very, very, very definitive rules. Like, what can this character do? This character would never do that. This character would never say that. And it's very specific. And so it's kind of taking these two worlds together, because you may remember there are some Disney character cameos in Muppet Vision, and so bringing those worlds together and kind of protecting the Disney of it all with the Muppets was so much fun and very challenging. But there are moments that really are the highlights of my life. I had the great honor, really, of getting to have lunch. They encouraged at the time, if you can believe, all Disney executives to, on the company, go out and have lunch with colleagues. I just didn't even realize how luxurious that was. And so we went out to lunch all the time. And of course, Disney had a commissary and I would go there with Jim frequently. And the lunches were always brainstorming sessions, dreaming. Imagine, what if we did this? You know, what if we did that? You know, one of the things when we lost Jim that just, I couldn't stop thinking about is just that incredible brain and all the unbelievable things that will never happen, we're going to come out of his his incredible brain. You know, he just was inspiring and warm and loving and just the most wonderful person to work with. And I'm so ecstatic to have had that opportunity in my life.
It's it really, and like watching, I mean, Alex, did you ever get to do it?
No. So, I mean, I've never, I have to admit, I am not, I wasn't before this hyper familiar with the Muppets. I know them. I know the characters growing up. It's hard to avoid Kermit and Fozzie and the two old guys. And but I'm not like a
Statler and Waldorf.
Exactly. I call them the two old guys. Okay. And before you, pre Nick Walker in my life, I wasn't familiar with Disney theme parks either.
Yeah, tell Dory that story. Tell her how that came about.
Well, so I mean, obviously, like this is like a weird eccentricity of Nick, right? is that he is an adult man, works hard, brings home the bacon, and he's got this weird, I don't even know what you'd call it.
You mean I'm very protective of my inner child? That's what you mean?
Yes. Well, that's a perfect. You've thought about this before. You framed this before for people. Yes, you're protecting your inner child with everything that you have. Yes. You love Disney parks. I love going to Disney, and then you know Universal on the side, and you've got, you know, there's things surrounding it, but Disney World, Disneyland. So I would obviously always make fun of you for it.
Yes.
Obviously, because why wouldn't I? And then one year you just decided to invite me along on you and Sarah's vacation.
I think I remember pitching it to you as when you come to this park, you will understand.
Yeah. Like, and I was like, ha. And I jumped on the opportunity to be like, you know what? It sounds like a week straight of like, Nick's going to book everything. We're going to drink the whole time. And just walk around and I'll be able to just make fun of it the whole time. And like literally from the time I hit the ground, like the like Magic Express that picks you up from the airport, I was in.
I was like, wait,
this is the best thing ever. Like everything is taken care of. There's so much attention to detail. There's so much attention to making sure that you're having a good experience. It's like if you can just remove any sort of cynicism, which isn't hard in that environment, it's like, it really is the most magical place on earth.
I was trying to tell, because and what I love about it is that detail, and is, especially for those of us who love film and love watching film. I mean, like, it's literally films that we grew up on come to life. And, you know, it's funny because like, I think that so much of what I've discovered about myself is like, I do have, when it comes to like things that I produce, my own content, like I have a very twisted mind and I love twisted humor. But like when it comes to me like relaxing and finding my joy, there's no other place that I'd rather be. And there's no, and like for my wife, like I'm very lucky with the person I married because there's no other place that she'd rather be. And we have all kind of formed this like this Disney family. I mean, Alex became an annual, you became an annual pass holder before I did.
Immediately I got back from Disney World. I live in LA and immediately was like, I got to go to Disneyland.
Yeah.
And I went and I think I signed up for the annual pass like as I showed up.
Yes. You're like, okay, yeah, I'll be going here. Yeah.
And now my wife, I started bringing her. She had the same idea like, oh, Disneyland, like, yeah, it'd be fun. I don't know why we'd spend money, you know, doing that, whatever. And I took her once or twice. And now it's like we have annual passes. Before COVID hit, at least we were going once, twice a month. Just love it. I mean, I'm drinking out of a mug we got there now. Like everything's just started to Disney-ify.
That's what it should be.
But so the Muppets are not Disney though.
Well, talk about that, Dory.
Well, first of all, you guys are my kind of people. I'm telling you, I'm with you completely. Actually, the story is awful, actually, but the end result and the answer to your question is yes, the Muppets are Disney. But when we were working on Muppet Vision, Jim was in the process of selling his company to Disney. He felt very strongly that he wanted his characters to live on forever and felt that Disney could take really great care of them. But to make a challenging story brief, when Jim passed away suddenly, totally unexpectedly, and the family came together, the deal was just seconds away from being signed. It wasn't signed at that point. And the clash between the Disney brass and the Henson family was right from the at the funeral, honestly. Which was very evident, and it did not go well, and it took years and years and years and years for these two entities to come back together and for Jim's wish to come true.
Wow.
That's a shame to hear.
But, you know, Disney's taking good care of the Muppets, so that's terrific.
You know, it's interesting, and I think this is always true, right? The kind of the intersection of art and commerce. And it's not, neither one is bad. You know, you have to sell in order to be able to make art, and you have to make art in order to sell art. But it's always a, you know, there's so many people who, you know, when I tell them about my love of Disney parks, you know, they're very quick to point out like the things that, like, it's like, you know, Disney's this big corporation and all this stuff. And I'm like, yes, I completely, this is, we know this, like, this is, there's no way you can avoid this. Then that's fine. What I love is what they put out. What I love is what goes into those parks. And if you can just take it, don't ignore it, but accept it, accept that's where this comes from. But also just know that what they're doing. You talk about Statler and Waldorf, that I remember that. So when I, you know, again, I'm a young kid going into this thing. I hate like enclosed spaces, to like any darkened theater always scares the crap out of me as a young kid. I was, you know, walking out of movies, walking out of the Indiana Jones ride. But when I sit down and then the first thing you hear is Statler and Waldorf just like ragging on this thing before it's even started. And you just all of a sudden just feel like, okay, like, well, that's cool. Like, okay, so they're gonna like make, because they just don't care. They're just making, oh my god.
Please tell me you can do the voices. Nick, oh my explain god. What we're seeing right now.
So you have Statler and Waldorf puppets or are they? That's your dolls. Yeah. Amazing.
We're just friends.
This is wonderful. What a wonderful day. I need to go to Shanghai. Tokyo Disney Sea. Sorry. Tokyo Disney. Have you either? I mean, I'm sure Dora, you've seen Alex, have you seen pictures from Tokyo?
I've seen some things.
Woo! That looks like a beautiful park.
It's so interesting when you think about how they had to figure out what are the unique cultural habits and what do they eat? What are they? Because when they opened Paris Disneyland, it did not go well because they just took Disney and they plopped it in France without thinking these things through. And yep. Oh my gosh, there was such a backlash because, you know, there's in France, they take these long lunches, they drink wine, they have facial hair, which you were not allowed to have at Disney parks. And so it just was a giant disaster. It failed completely. And then they had to stop and say, oh, okay, we're in France. What are they doing?
Oh, we have to adapt to the local culture. Who would have known?
But let's rope it back into the point of this podcast, because we could talk about these parks forever. So what we, you know, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't already know what we do on this podcast, we pick a theme every week and we pick a movie that we think in our hearts best exemplifies that theme. Obviously, with Dory on this week, the best thing that we could pick would be the Muppet movie. And it's funny because, Alex, as you noted, there are only
eight Muppet movies.
Eight
from 1979 to 2014. Earliest to latest. Yeah. So, I mean, this one kind of has, since there's only so many choices, we'll have to approach it a little bit differently.
Just a smidge.
Because we'll get through about half of all the existing Muppet movies. Like I said, like, I didn't have a whole lot. I obviously, like, everyone's aware of the Muppets in general, but I haven't really engaged with them since I was a kid. And what I noticed watching through my film is that these are very geared towards adults.
Yeah.
And I get like, okay, it's very punny. It's very like, ha, ha, ha. As a kid, you pick up on that, but you're just kind of watching these puppets dance around and laughing along, and it's colorful and it's whatever. But my movie, the one I picked, was grittier than I thought it'd be. It was subtler than I thought it would be. You know, I think the last Muppet movie I saw was the Jason Segel one from 2011. And that was my last experience with it, which I think is a little, it seemed geared more commercially, right? Like, yeah. it was brighter and louder. And at a point in time when everyone knew the Muppets and it was trying to bring it back in a really big, loud way. But mine goes all the way back to the start. We're coming in. It's a helicopter shot. It seems like it's almost out of like Apocalypse Now or something like that, coming in over the swamp, right? Mm-hmm. Just a helicopter pushing closer and closer and closer down over these trees. You start hearing a banjo playing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, come on.
It fades into the set, this like beautiful swamp set. And it's just it's so simple and so beautiful. It's just Kermit sitting on a log playing Rainbow Connection.
Yep. I mean,
it's the original 1979.
Yeah, where else start but the first? Yeah.
The that Muppet is- movie.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows? And what's on the other side? Rainbows.
And it's amazing because the song itself has such a legacy, right? And I immediately jumped to the recording of Jim Henson's Funeral. Mm-hmm. Where they get up and sing, and like I've watched that, so like anytime God, I need to cry, I'll put on Jim Henson's Funeral and play, seeing Big Bird and all the, you know, singing Rainbow Connection and just like breaking down did it. So like seeing this at the very beginning, right? This is the first big thing, seeing this in its natural habitat, so to speak, where it came from. Just kind of struck a real chord with me. And then the rest of the movie, watching, you know, every single line of dialogue is so honed in. Everything is double entendre. Everything is a pun. Mm-hmm. Everything is a joke. Everything has some deeper, you know, meaning to it, some critique or context, and it's sharp. That's what I was surprised about is, you know, for a 1979 puppet movie, this thing is biting. It is sharp. Yeah.
Also, consider who you have as cameos in that film. You have some of like the best comedic faces of that generation. You have Dom DeLuise. You have Madeline Kahn, who's like, I mean, come on. You have, I think you have Steve Martin in there?
Steve Martin in the wine scene. Burrell, yeah. Bob Hope.
Oh, Elliot Gould.
Richard Pryor.
Orson Welles. Yeah.
Orson like, Welles. Yeah. Can you believe that?
Orson Welles.
Yeah. It just, everyone showed... You know, that's, I mean, that speaks to me of the magic of this thing, because, you know, so many, like, you realize, like, you know, so many of these cameos, I mean, and Dory, maybe you can speak to this, but like, when you're setting up cameos like that, I mean, that's a cold call and say, hey, especially in the original Muppet movie before it's like, you know, obviously we know about the Muppets, they'd had a history before then, but like, you know, who knows if a Muppet movie is going to work. You're calling people like, yo, do you want to get in on this? Or go ahead.
When they shot the Muppet movie, which is my favorite too, for sure. They were already a gigantic hit as a television series in the 1970s. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. The Muppets were huge, and so it was like you know, guest starring on Glee or something. You know, it's like everybody wanted that moment, and so they had a lot of these cameos. A lot of these people and many, many other big names had already made cameo appearances on the Muppet Show. Wow. And so when they decided to make the movie, it was, I don't think that was a difficult part of it, you know, figuring out how to get Kermit to ride a bike and Fozzie to drive a car. That was really insane. You know, that was crazy. But, you know, to your point, it's wacky and so much comedy and everything, but you know, the heart of that film and what it's about is just, to me, you know, as a kid, it was like so many life lessons. Like Kermit was excited about the opportunity when he was discovered, so to speak, in the swamp by the idea of chasing his dream to make millions of people happy.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. There's an ad in here that you should be very interested in. Feast your eyes on that.
Worldwide Studios announces open auditions for frogs wishing to become rich and famous. Well, thanks anyway, but I'm really pretty happy where I am.
Oh, if I were you, I would give this audition very careful consideration. You've got talent, kid. Singing, telling jokes. I mean, if you get your tongue fixed, who knows? You can make millions of people happy.
Millions of people happy.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
Great expectations.
The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
I mean, I love that. You know, I love that.
It spoke to who Kermit was immediately. Like it set up without it. You could never have seen the Muppets before ever. And you immediately get in the first 10 minutes who Kermit is and what the whole brand stands for. You kind of felt that Jim Henson mindset, you know, why this existed to begin with in just those few lines.
It's so funny when I so the Museum of the Moving Image is right here in Queens, and they have had a Jim Henson exhibit. Have you seen it, Dory?
Absolutely.
And they've, I mean, it's been up here for now, I think like 3-4 years, but one of the things that is just consistent through all the points of the exhibition is just from the beginning, his creativity. And just the fact, I mean, so, you know, he was drawing these cartoons when he was a kid. Do you mean like this was always something that he was, you know, called to do and was always innovating in terms of how do we make these creatures feel more lifelike and more welcoming and more open? And what I've always loved is the behind the scenes footage when they were doing the test footage for this movie. You just see how connected he and Frank Oz are to these yeah. Like they are just riffing, and like I think there's like one segment that they show in the Museum of the Moving Image where it's like them, they were just like, it's like a test, you know, filming where like they're just looking at like cows and like riffing on cows and trying to like talk to cows as their characters, and like they're just having this full conversation back and forth, not a beat between them, like literally just talking as their characters and like fully animating their it just the connection they had to these characters shines through in that movie so well.
Their ability to speak to kids,
yeah,
you know, so yeah, beautifully, but then also completely to the adult audience was at the same time was just so masterful. Like, you know, when in the movie they run into Floyd Pepper, the rock star guy, mm-hmm, and they say, you know, do you want to go on the journey with us? Because you're so talented, you could be discovered and, you know, have great fame and fortune in Hollywood. He literally says to them, when you get rich and famous, we'll show up to exploit your wealth.
Wow.
I mean, wow. What, an 8-year-old, that's just going to go over their head. But I mean, to an adult, that's hysterical. That's crazy.
Oh yeah. I mean, to your point, that's what I was going to say is like, whereas somebody like Mr. Rogers, right, from his core doing what he does, but it's geared towards the kids, right? The whole thing is about helping kids through their issues and growing up and dealing with what's about to come hit them in adulthood. And I think what I never understood about the Muppets until now is, you know, yes, it's for kids. Yes, it's those messages are in there. This is all really speaking to everybody, to adults. It's visually for kids, but it is, you know, emotionally, thematically, educationally for adults. And you don't find that very often.
No, and the lyrics, the score by Paul Williams is so spectacular with Rainbow Connection, oh, and yeah, Moving Right Along. Mm-hmm. And there's a line that I've always kept in mind in the reprise of Rainbow Connection, the final song in the movie. It says,
"Life's like a movie, write your own ending."
That message is just such a great thing for a kid to hear. You know, it just is so empowering. And for anyone to hear, maybe who's going through a difficult time, you know, just write your own ending.
It really speaks volumes. And the pure joy that was captured, I think, and the pure kind of hope, you know, that's captured has continued on. Like, you can't, and I think that's kind of always been the ballast, right, to kind of judge these movies. Because, you know, when you feel them getting away from that, is when I start to kind of shut off, you know, when I not that you have to, because you can't, you know, I think that's what's so hard about it is like that kind of joy you can't mass produce. Like it has to be crafted and it has to be every intricate detail. But I just know that like when I feel it start to slip away is when you just kind of throw the, so, okay, great. We have the Muppets. Everybody loves the Muppets. Let's throw them into a plot. You know, and then we lose a little bit of that, and that is kind of, at least for me, that's kind of when I kind of shrink away. But Dory, so you were saying this, so that would be your pick as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, we get to meet all the characters, and actually there were a lot of characters and moments in the Muppet movie that were we saw again in Muppet Vision 3D, whether it's, you know, the Swedish chef.
The film is okie dokie.
Good, roll film.
Film is ruling.
You know, or Fozzie Bear trying to be a stand-up comedian.
Here I am, Fozzie Bear, to tell you jokes both old and rare. Waka, waka, waka. Ah. Hey, let's start things off with a bang. Thank you, sir.
To me, that is like an almost perfect movie, because it's wacky and crazy, and technically at the time, at least 1979, off the charts, but it's not overly sentimental, you know?
No.
And it didn't feel forced, as you were saying, you know, it just felt like you are on this wacky adventure with these characters, and you want Kermit to succeed, and you want him to chase his dream and get it, that he's going to make millions of people happy.
Yep.
Simple.
Yep. It's so funny because my choice. So the three movies that I'd watch were that one. I watched it, and obviously that one, I was by 2 a.m. I was tearing up crying. And then I fell asleep on what was my second choice, which was the Muppets, the 2011 Muppets. Because here's what I will say for that. It is flashy. It is crazy. But what I think is wonderful about it is very much in the same way, Dory, that you've described Jim Henson bringing himself to this first film. I think you can feel that Jason Segel brought his fandom to this film. And that's what makes it work, was just like, oh, you're telling the story about how much these characters meant to you. And I can get behind that. And so for as much as it was like very much a 2011, like Muppets reboot, it was also like there was, by the end of it, like that final speech that Kermit gives, where he's, in classic Muppets fashion, they try to have a fundraiser to get their show back going, and they fail. And Kermit gives this amazing rousing speech about, it doesn't matter if we fail because we did this together. And that's all I care about. And it's just like one of the most pure sentiments. And I, every time I see it, I cry. And it's just so well done. But the movie that I decided on, and this is kind of why I brought it up. I think that if they, there was, like I said, there was a time there in the 90s into, I think, maybe a little bit of the 2000s, where they were trying to just plug the Muppets into different stories. And a lot of those didn't work for me, but one of them really did. One of them, I think, has to be my favorite.
Is this why Tim Curry is on our Twitter?
It is not why Tim Curry. See, you already, but it's close, because I think that's a second. I think that's a runner up. I think it's an absolute runner up but that one to me, so Muppet Treasure Island, I think works solely on Tim Curry's performance.
Yeah.
Because he's amazing. And my problem with that one is the Muppets take such a back seat in that movie.
Gotcha.
It's not about the Muppets. But this one is, in so many ways. It's about, it's about the innovation that it takes to, even though they're not the central character, it is about the innovation it takes to create a world that is this efficient at storytelling. So we open, you're going to know what it is from the time I describe it, but we open on foggy London town.
Yeah,
I know it.
Exactly. It's the Muppets Take Manhattan. Oh,
shut up. I'll kill you.
There he is, Mr. Ebenezer Scrooge. Say, is it getting cold around here?
So this was, and Dory, correct me if I'm wrong, I think this was the first movie that they were going to do post Jim Henson's death.
Right.
It was 91. And Brian Henson, who was his son, was approached to, the story went that he was told, he was like, yeah, we would love to do an adaptation of The Christmas Carol. We think you should do it. And I think it was originally supposed to be a series. They wanted like a television series. Through, as development happens, it became a movie. And they brought on Michael Caine. Michael Caine. I've always felt that he's just one of the most emotionally connected actors that we have, and sometimes I think that it's overdone, but like in this movie, it was to me, honest, and I'm somebody's gonna punch me in the face for saying this. I think this is one of his best performances.
Oh, spirit, do not leave me.
I think I must, in fact.
You have meant so much to me. You have changed me.
And now I leave you with the ghost of Christmas yet to come.
You mean the future? Master?
And I think it's one of his best, because I think what he did that's brilliant is he says in interviews, he's like, I'm going to play this like this is the Royal Shakespeare Company production of Christmas Carol. And so what that allowed him to do was he was as mean as he could be. And he really used that camera to great effect, to be as mean as he could be. And because he is surrounded by the Muppets, the dichotomy becomes is you have the most vulnerable creatures in the world. By their very nature, they are open and they are kind and they are loving and they just want to be there for him. And he just craps on all of them. And so all of a sudden, this Christmas Carol story of this horrible man becomes, gets put into probably the starkest relief since Charles Dickens first wrote the story, because you're able to really see the effect of his meanness.
Now then, sir, about the donation?
Let's see. I know how to treat the poor. My taxes go to pay for the prisons and the poorhouses. The homeless must go there.
But some would rather die.
If they'd rather die, then they'd better do it and decrease the surplus population.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
This is the door. You may use it.
Like, I think about the face that, you know, when, so he has Kermit as his kind of Bob Cratchit, and Kermit's working in his office, and he asks,
excuse me, Mr. Scrooge, but it appears to be closing time.
Very well. I'll see you at 8 tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow's Christmas.
8:30 then.
You know, in that wonderful Kermit way, he's like so unassuming and just like so hopeful that this man will say yes, even though it's so clear he's going to say no. And it just breaks your heart. And all his little rat friends are like around and like, they're hoping that he's going to say yes. And then he just obliterates them. And yet Kermit goes and gets his son, his little Tiny Tim, and this amazing sequence, which you see Kermit walking, right? You see his legs moving, and the way they did it was I was watching behind the scenes videos. They made a set that was like a rotating set, right? So you just had his legs moving like this, and then they just rotated a set almost like a globe behind him. So you just saw like the curvature of the street and the houses passing by in such a way. And it's just, and they're, but they're, you know, even though he's not going to get to spend Christmas with his family, he's still singing this like happy song. And then there's so many sequences that just moved me. So many technical sequences that are brilliant. The knocker on the door. There's a knocker when he goes back to his house, the knocker just becomes a face and terrifies him. And it's just this beautiful kind of rubbery movement that just really freaks you out. And truly one of these scary, you know, I think whenever you're watching A Christmas Carol Story, you know, it's, you can always tell how good it is by how they do the Ghost of Christmas Future. The best ones are terrifying. And like, I think about like Scrooged, which was like kind of scary, but you know, mock scary, is Bill Murray scary. This one is scary AF, man. This is like some, I
don't
like
remember it. Can you?
It's just, so it's got these, it's, you know, the only thing that kind of gives it a little bit of clownish is its hands. The hands are like these kind of, you know, round, bluish, gray, rubbery hands, long fingers. But the rest of it is just this massive shroud and a complete darkness. And you also have Michael Caine playing against it. So Michael Caine is giving it all the fright that he can, and just, you know, cowering before this creature. It's also massive. It's huge. And it just, there's no, the brilliance of it and the brilliance of the character in general is there's no emotion to it. He's not there to have sympathy. You know, the rest of the characters kind of like, we're like, hey, you know, we want you to be better, so be better. This one's like, nope.
Yeah.
This is what happens. And that kind of bluntness and lack of answer. Also again, and I think this was another masterful touch to, you know, Brian Henson talks about how they originally wanted like a Charles Dickens-esque character to narrate the story, and he chooses Gonzo and Rizzo. And they were like, why? And he was like, because they are the least Dickens-esque characters.
Delicious, your Christmas apple.
Red, delicious.
Tuppence a piece while they last.
We
They won't last long the way you're eating them.
Hey, I'm creating scarcity. Drives the prices up.
Rizzo. Hello. Welcome to the Muppet Christmas Carol.
And it's brilliant because they are able to provide a great commentary on the story. And again, be kind of like Statler and Waldorf were for me in the Muppet Vision 3D. They make it that much less scary. They're like, ooh, this is, they warn you. They're like, hey, this is the scary part. So we're going to go and we'll be back when it's over. And like, I don't know. I just felt like you could feel, and maybe this is me projecting onto the film, but you could just feel the heart that they were putting into it because they knew that they had to carry on this man's legacy.
I mean, I think the Christmas Carol is a great format for the Muppets, right? Because the heart of a Christmas Carol is all about, you know, about melting people's ice and about believing and hoping, you know, in the hope of humanity, right? It's about you can be better, you know, you are loved. There's, you know, the future can be what you want it to be. And that's the message of the Muppets. The Rainbow Connection is not about look how great everything is. It's about one day we're gonna figure it out.
We'll find it.
One day we'll find it. And I think, you know, obviously with the ghost of Christmas future and everything, like that's what Christmas Carol is about. So I think on some level, the story just works thematically.
It really does.
There are also little treasures in all the movies. And in the Christmas Carol, I remember the shooting star, you know, over Kermit's head. And that was very specifically done as a tribute to Jim Henson.
Yeah, you can, and again, I always I always look for the ways in which the creators put themselves in their films. The time that we spend with Bob Cratchit and his son, there's just something very special about that.
Yeah.
And especially knowing where this film came from. Yeah, man. So that's the that's my pick. But it's, you know, I think look, if you just, especially in these days when life is crazy, these are not bad movies to watch. I would highly recommend putting on one of these films just because it's just pure joy. It's just like stupid, pure fun. Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong.
It's hard for me not, given, you know, having had the honor of working with them, to look at these movies and not know what was, you know, you can get, I of course get totally swept up in the emotion and the humor. And, you know, A Christmas Carol is such a good example of that. It really was just beautifully told and all that. But it's also kind of extraordinary to think like just a walking scene of Kermit. I know that took 10 puppeteers to make that happen. You know, so the technical genius behind all that, and to do it in a way that is so seamless that you can, it doesn't give you a second to step out of the movie and think those thoughts, you know, you're with it, you're with Kermit, you're with the whole story. And, but there's this massive technical machine behind it that's real. It's not animation, you know, it's authentic.
This is why, Nick, when you told me Muppets was the theme for this, I had to clarify, like, okay, like just the Muppets, like as the brand, you're like, yeah, we have to. Because I would have gone straight for Labyrinth.
I mean, Labyrinth is...
And in terms of technical achievement in puppetry, you know, I used to live on the behind-the-scenes featurettes from Labyrinth just because, like, the amount of imagination that went into... created, because it's not just the puppets, right? It's not just about moving the puppets. It's how the puppets interact with the environments around them, right? And these environments are built to try to, you know, you hide the hands and the strings and all that. But Muppets doesn't, you know, we're not, it wasn't in an age where they could take the wires out, where they could hide all this stuff and do it easily. There's no CGI, there's no anything. So to watch the ingenious workarounds, you know, is magic in and of itself. And it's
now Dory, just a question for you. So as a producer of, you know, theater and you know, and Imagineer and all these wonderful things, so when you look at a process like that, when somebody, you know, when you're having these meetings and it's like, how, you know, what is this going to take to film this scene, and you know that you're going to be stuck on one scene for like three weeks, in your producer brain, is it just automatically like, you know, I mean, with the Muppets, I guess you have a proven entity, but is it automatically worth it? Or is it like, are you thinking, okay, how can we still most efficiently get this done? Or like, at what point is it like a scene that just needs to be cut because it's just too complicated?
Well, with Muppet Vision 3D, the Muppets were obviously established and well known when we made the film. But what we did, and what was kind of my operating rule with Disney, with theme park productions, was it had to absolutely push the medium to a whole new place. You couldn't do things that were done before. It had to set a whole new bar. So it was the Muppets, which in and of itself, as we've talked about, is challenging. It's really challenging and technically complex, you know, aside from all the genius humor and all of that. But then it was the first time ever that CGI was used in 3D. So the whole movie was shot in 3D for starters, which at the time in 1991, there is a lot you can do now that has been simplified technically, but we had humongous 3D cameras. I mean, massive 3D cameras. And the technical team around that was the state of the art. So I learned so much from them, and they were all so kind, and it all had to be very, very collaborative, because we also had, as I mentioned, CGI characters, computer graphics characters. And in 1991, that was kind of a new thing. And it was the first time that you would have a CGI character in a 3D film. So it was the added layers of complexity with these puppet characters. So imagine that they're hidden, they're underground, looking at their puppet through a monitor with their hand in the air, probably in a very uncomfortable position, acting while opposite perhaps a 3D character that doesn't exist at the moment. You know, so the level of complexity to shoot that, you know, 13-minute movie was off the charts. It was crazy.
Are you aware, as you're watching this happen, are you aware of, like, okay, we need to give somebody a break, because, like, they've just been in that position for so long? Like are they pushing through these takes? Are they, like, I mean, are they cramping out? Like, I mean, because that's for everyone involved, that just seems like such a task.
Well, with the Muppets, you know, it's a very different situation, because, you know, we've had to be completely deferential. And, you know, we really became, because we had worked on a number of things together, not just Muppet Vision. Everyone had bonded. It was such a tight, tight team of people. And they know their craft, you know?
Gotcha.
And what we were able to bring to the table were help support them with these brilliant Imagineers, and then also to anticipate this live action that was being captured on screen. They were going to be interacting with Statler and Waldorf live in the theater, you know, and how, what are the sight lines? What are the, you know, so to help and support them with all the technical expertise of the Imagineers that would be building the theater and all that. It was a very, very, very collaborative process. But in terms of, you know, when there are breaks and how far can, you know, how long can Miss Piggy work before she needs to take a rest? That was totally, you know, Frank Oz's call. But it was a dream project. And I think because of its massive complexity, ever since then, you know, no problem, we'll figure it out. nothing has ever been a challenge.
That's what I was about to say, because I was like, you know, even it's, you know, with the prom and with all the Broadway stuff that you've produced, like, it also occurs to me, like, wow, if you've been able to do that, I mean, it's crazy as Broadway can get, because Broadway gets crazy, but, like, that just seems like, yeah, you could do it. It's a cakewalk in a way, right? Or is it?
Well, it was thrilling. It was absolutely thrilling, because the mandate basically was to create things that don't exist. And so, you know, when you see films or Broadway shows that are so derivative of something else, it's so frustrating. What a missed opportunity to be, you know, create things that are brand new and push the medium. And to me, that's what's really exciting. And to bring this genius group of people together and watch them work at the top of their craft, it was extraordinary.
No, I can't even imagine. Can't even imagine.
I do have to say, though, that they were also a blast. They were so much fun. I got to be in Muppet Vision, I got to be a penguin in the finale scene. Yes, I am a penguin. and even the audio for a penguin.
The legacy. That is the legacy. You know,
they were all so just like the nicest group of people ever. And so much fun to work with.
That's my dream. I literally, so when I, you know, because I think the show is done now, but great moments in history in the parks, which I, again, it's, it was this amazing, I think it's done. I don't think they do it anymore. But I literally, one of my dreams was like, yo, if this theater thing, if this acting thing doesn't work out, that's my first, I'm audition. I don't even care what I had to do. I will be there.
Isn't that all there. Animatronic robots?
No, it's voice recorded. So the, obviously the voices are record pre-recorded, but it's, everyone up there is doing, it's like the people in the window, they're doing it.
Right.
And I was like, I will figure out how to worm my way into that world because that's awesome. But no, Dory, thank you so much for coming on and chatting with
me. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you both.
Amazing.
Nothing but a pleasure. But yeah, guys, watch some Muppet movies. Take care of yourselves. You know, stay out of trouble. And we will see you next week.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Little justice. Little justice. Little justice. Fuck yeah.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah, not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.